Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, and these early and still wintry nights of spring. But the northern hemisphere has passed through the vernal equinox. And now it is springtime officially. When the days are sunny, I hear it in the joyful noise of the songbirds. I see it in the return of Old Man Lizard, the foot-long, desert-spiny lizard who graciously shares the patio with me and has emerged from wherever he slumbers through the coldest months. I was especially grateful for his return because I'd seen a long, hate-filled centipede testing the patio door for a way in just the other night. And then just last night, after I returned home and reached for the kitchen light switch, my fingers brushed something moving up the wall, along the edge of the cabinet. 4 inches of pure biological sin. It wanted to fight me, like all of them. No point trying to get it into a water glass so I could throw it across the neighbor's fence. What I had to do was kill it before it disappeared into the walls, under the cabinets, into the sofa, into the bedding. Otherwise, if it was female, and who can tell, it would lay at 60 or so eggs. Think about that for a minute, if you can. Do they bite? Hell yes, they bite, and it hurts like hell too. A big one can tear up the end of your finger or toe enough to cause an infection if you don't clean it up and dry it out, but that's true of any small wound. They won't kill you. I mean, they want to kill you. They dream all winter about killing you, but they lack the ammunition. Before I could grab something big enough to smack it with, it cleverly dropped to the floor and rushed for the crack under the baseboards. I got it, fouling the sole of my right boot, but I missed the head in the first few rows of legs, still ready to fight, reared up from the goop on the tile floor. Incredible creatures. I wish a house full of them on all my enemies. Especially those who keep desert spiny lizards, or any lizard, any reptile, confined as a so-called pet, locked in a Petco or Walmart terrarium, a glass prison, life in prison. Here's how you know if a creature is a pet. It returns to you of its own accord. If lost, it seeks home. This can be true of farm animals, of course, even though their fate is to produce food and various byproducts rather than companionship. Leather for shoes, wool for clothing, chicken feet for voodoo rituals, etc. Although I do remember bellying up to the Basque Bar up in Gardnerville one evening when the herders had just come down with their sheep. Yes, they cursed the sheep a dozen ways in 3 languages, but they also told stories about the goofy animals, of bold rescues, of lost lambs brought back into the fold. The sheep are companions to the shepherd all season long, in a way the cow is very much not the companion of the cowboy. A cowboy is bound only to his horse. A real cowboy, anyway. The cow is something to find somewhere out there, and then herd it back to the grim enclosure with its ominous loading chute. As long as the cow can't see where it's going, it will go all the way on its own, right up to the fateful moment when it realizes, from the heavy psychic dread left behind by hundreds of cattle before it, that this is Act 3, and there's no Act 4. A half century ago, my parents gave me a blue-dyed duck for Easter Sunday. People would sell them on country roads for a dollar or more than farm duckling prices. A few drops of watered-down food coloring applied to the duckling's down, which would soon be replaced by feathers, and is the perfect Easter present for parents who have no concept of next month. This duck quickly grew to enormous size and had the run of our side of the double shotgun house, this being the lower ninth ward of New Orleans. Out back was a small yard shaded by a fig tree, and the duck grew fat that summer on the ripe and fallen fruit and the dog food. We had at the time a couple of little dogs, house dogs, and the duck got along well enough with the canines. But it also bullied them mercilessly when canned dog food was on the menu, or something better. The duck had imprinted upon me, as the bird people say, so it enjoyed following me up and down the long, narrow house. It used the dog door with ease and enjoyed the plastic kiddie pool outside, keeping it mostly free of mosquitoes. Eventually, when I began kindergarten that autumn, the adults who had made the decision to bring home a farm duck now decided it was time to get rid of it. Being simple working-class people, they decided to dump it at City Park, where a colony of mostly abandoned pet ducks had the run of a large pond near the merry-go-round. I suppose I should be grateful they took me along to see off my dear friend, the duck. Other unwanted pets simply disappeared, often with an unconvincing cover story. Like the sad excuse for a beagle they bought out of the newspaper classifieds, I was told they had given it away for obscure reasons. I was only 2 or 3 years old, but I was not a complete idiot. Not yet. When I awoke from a nap and saw the plywood doghouse burning in the backyard, I did have some questions. Anyway, the ill-advised Easter pet was brought to the pond and released. It was seemingly baffled at the sight of so many other ducks. There were more ducks in the world? Cautiously, it wandered over and was welcomed without any violence. But it kept looking back at me, and I encouraged it to make friends, having accepted my parents' decision. And I was glad to see my Easter pet making friends of its own kind. We, the people I mean, began to walk away, back to the asphalt parking area beyond the green, and got no more than a few yards when my loyal duck was again at my side. This went on for another hour or two, but eventually, as we stepped away, gradually, slowly, my duck did not follow. At the time, I suppose I believed that it wanted to stay in the pond, that it understood. But maybe it felt rejected, depressed, and just quit trying. We all know that feeling.
Desert Oracle Radio.
With Soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. We live in a strange time. A time when medicine has advanced to the point that rich people can be kept alive and sort of functioning well into their 9th and 10th decades. Keep their CEO jobs, their safe Senate seats, their chairmanships of the boards of directors. This has created some bad feelings amongst the 315 million Americans under the age of 74, who increasingly feel like the changing of the guard has simply failed to happen for the past several decades now, for a couple of generations. The last relatively young president was Barack Obama, a baby boomer, first elected some 2 decades ago. Bill Clinton was considered pretty young for a president when he took office in 1993 at the age of 46. His successor, George W. Bush, was 54 years old when he took office in 2001. And both were born the same year as Donald Trump, who took office in 2017 at the age of 70, and is currently the favorite for the 2024 election, meaning he would be 78 years old when he returned to office. All three, Clinton, Bush Jr., Trump, were born in the summer of 1946. The current president, who will be 82 years old should he take the oath a second time next year, was born in 1942, just after the Battle of Midway, America's first great naval battle against Imperial Japan, having entered World War II 6 months earlier. What is his Trivial Pursuit? No. There's a point to it, which is this. All of them were infants or young children at most, even old Uncle Joe, when America lost its ancient soul. What I'm talking about here is what the early beat poet Kenneth Rexroth called the old weird America, a mostly rural land of horse-drawn buggies and ox-drawn plows, a time when the wireless radio and the printed newspaper connected far-flung people to the world, and only 8,000 television sets were in use in 1946, and only the big cities were broadcasting a few odd bits of programming. A boxing match, some radio quiz shows carried over to the new format, and James Beard's cooking program, I Love to Eat. Don't we all? For most Americans of the early and middle 1940s, when nearly half the people still lived in rural areas and small towns, life moved to an ancient rhythm, seasons and harvest. The church in its graveyard, Saturday nights at the honky-tonk, chicken coops and vegetable gardens, the delivery of ice blocks and milk bottles, spook lights and haints, cloth-draped mirrors after someone died in the house, as most people did. You might paint the porch blue to keep wayward spirits from entering. The white lady glided silently through the woods and along the old canals. Monstrous, phantom black dogs prowled the fields unfazed by bullets. And everybody knew the old songs, work songs and church songs, murder ballads and drinking songs, dancing jigs, some with melodies from the Middle Ages, and words from the time of Shakespeare. The presidents, of course, grew up in the mostly modern world, mostly in worlds of wealth and privilege. Only Bill Clinton came from small-town America, although he was born in a hospital like every president since Jimmy Carter, and he went to college at Georgetown, and Oxford, and Yale. That strange old world was already gone before they had grown up. The haunted world of ghost and God. The rural music, hillbilly and blues, polka and waltz and western. It all became electrified. People moved in droves to the crowded, filthy cities to make war machines for Boeing in Seattle, Chrysler and Ford in Detroit, Douglas Aircraft in Los Angeles. With the Manhattan Project and Trinity Test in New Mexico, the transfer of Hitler's aerospace program to the United States, and finally the brutal and pointless destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the war was over. The new era had begun. The American century, historians name the 30 years between World War II and the defeat in Vietnam. From our feeble presidents to the ailing King Charles to seemingly vigorous older people like Bernie Sanders, Pam Grier, Mick Jagger, Larry David, Meryl Streep, this was a generation that grew up without the old supernatural world, the old forms of common folk religion and mysticism, folkways common 1,000 years ago, humanity's essential partner. From the very beginning, religion was born around the campfire, as were fairy tales and monster stories, fables and philosophy. But after the summer of 1947, when military men and their willing conspirators began spreading the tales of technological aircraft and alien enemies through the popular mediums of radio, newspaper, wire services, pulp magazines, dime store paperbacks, the old haunted world died. Some say the UFO era began with the Foo Fighters in both the Atlantic and Pacific theaters of World War II, where aircraft crews began encountering balls of brilliant light and shapes of energy that could pace aircraft or race aircraft, or sometimes, and most disturbingly, shoot right towards aircraft as if they were going to collide intentionally. And then they either blinked out of existence or stopped on a dime and shot off at speeds no one had ever seen any aircraft or even the new rockets achieve. There were scattered news reports of such things, always with a strong suggestion that either Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan was behind the encounters. Foo Fighter reports contained absolutely no suggestion of or reference to the then uncommon idea of interplanetary spaceships piloted by humanoid monsters. Yes, H.G. Wells had popularized the Martian invasion story with Victorian audiences. And Orson Welles freaked out American radio listeners in 1938 with his adaptation of the tale. But old-fashioned monstrosities still reigned supreme throughout the 1940s and into the next decade. Vampires and werewolves and zombies and reanimated corpses. All the earthiest of creatures, creatures of the woods and the swamps and the graveyards. The origin of the term FOO, Foo Fighters, is unproven and obscure. But a commonly accepted etymological possibility is the French word for flame, like when you need your cigarette lit. In popular use during the war, because a speech challenge Funny Pages character, Fireman Smokey Stover, called himself a Foo Fighter rather than a firefighter. Where there's foo, there's fire. Such was his catchphrase. Foo Follet, of course, is a ghost light, a spook light. The Acadian French brought the term to Louisiana in the 18th century, where it remains in use amongst the Cajuns to describe those eerie and seemingly intelligent balls of light that trouble people on dark nights. Dark nights on the swamps, dark nights in the piney woods, on the country roads under a canopy of darkened trees. Fool's fire, what the Scottish call will-o'-the-wisp. The Japanese have more than a dozen terms for spook lights, often said to be ghosts of the dead or unborn, or ghosts of magical animals, like the fox. Speaking of ghosts, the other pre-USA flying saucer flap occurred in Northern Europe, Scandinavia mostly, between February and August of 1946. The Swedish and Finnish ghost rockets were very much like the UFOs soon to trouble America's post-war victory years. And people in Northern Europe certainly knew what missiles were by the end of World War II. They'd seen these new tools of war cross the skies, their southern skies, from Germany to England, to the British Isles. These phantoms sometimes hung in the sky for minutes or even hours and could make impossible maneuvers before vanishing entirely or dramatically crashing into lakes, often with many witnesses. Lakes where no sign of missiles were ever found, even when dive teams and dredges were brought in. The strange behavior of the disappearing missiles made it natural, or supernatural, to call them ghostly, as people had always done in such situations. It would take the American media, egged on by U.S. intelligence and military men, to implant the idea in the world's consciousness that these strange forms of energy, seen by so many and imagined by so many more during the early days of the flying saucer frenzy, were not visions, were not wonders in the sky, apparitions of Mother Mary or Krishna or Kali, or otherwise omens and signs of things to come. They were, instead, aircraft. Silvery, high-speed, mysterious, metallic aircraft. In fact, 1940s flying saucers even had the same finish as military test aircraft of the day. Metallic. Rivets and seams were commonly reported, as were wings, fins, windows, and doors. It has long been a cliché to dismiss things as fairy tales, whether regarding love or luck or the strange experiences some people have had over the centuries and beyond. "You're too old to believe in fairy tales," a tough-minded broad might say to the private dick. Late in my own life, I've come to realize that fairy tales hold more truth about the unexplained, about the real magic that sometimes appears in our lives, than all the shady flying saucer stories spun by military men and intelligence agencies and their ever-willing co-conspirators, from the producers of Ancient Aliens to the editors of the New York Times. The man who started the frenzy, the man who turned the mysterious and the sublime into the mechanical, was the businessman, private pilot, and Foo Fighter equipment salesman, Kenneth Arnold. Firefighting equipment. Listen to this. Arnold started his own company, the Great Western Fire Control Supply, in Boise, Idaho, which sold and installed fire suppression systems, a job that took him around the Pacific Northwest. When you need a fire suppression system, just get on the horn with Ken Arnold over in Boise, see if he can fly over here to Spokane tomorrow in his airplane, a brand new Callair A2, one of the 16 Callair A2 two-seater personal planes ever built. plenty of Americans were getting by without a car in 1947. And here's the fire extinguisher salesman tooling around in a brand new hot rod airplane like he's... Well, James Bond did not exist yet. And we remember Kenneth Louise Arnold as the person who coined the term flying saucers accidentally, and for consistently pushing the idea of extraplanetary creatures flying fantastic craft in Earth's atmosphere. And he stuck to that for the rest of his life, although he did take breaks to campaign for Barry Goldwater and also to run for lieutenant governor in Idaho on the Republican ticket. On June 24, 1947, as the story goes, Kenneth Arnold was flying his A-2 east towards Yakima, taking a side route to search for the Marine Corps C-46 transport that had crashed into Mount Rainier the previous winter. The lengthy daylight sighting, he later described to local newspapers and eventually to the FBI, involved a fleet of rounded batwing craft zipping along from Mount Rainier to Mount Adams at 1,700 miles per hour. Lockheed's P-80 jet had set the world airspeed record only 5 days earlier when test pilot Albert Boyd pushed his P-80R to 624 miles per hour. 1,000 miles per hour and change slower than the Washington State flying saucers. And what made Arnold's sighting especially credible was the half dozen other sightings over Washington and Idaho during that week and the week or so after, including the July 4th, 1947 sighting by a United Airlines crew headed for Seattle. On this Easter weekend, let's do our best to bring back the ghosts, the supernatural, mysterious entities that come not from some imagined distant star system in the cold, lifeless vacuum of space, but from right here where we experience them, back roads, mountains, spooky desert trails at dusk. I think that's what Jesus would have wanted. He loved wilderness and often talked to ghosts, after all. Good night from the voice of the desert.